Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. We welcome you to the airwaves of Radio Islam International this Tuesday morning. Once again, it is the Tajir program. In this program, we unpack and discuss various economics, business and financial issues. We welcome you on the program. Our guest on this program is Mufti Muhammad Hafiji. Mufti Saab is from the Jamiatul Ulama South Africa's Economics and Finance Desk. Mufti Saab has, alhamdulillah, joined us in the studio this morning. Mufti Saab, assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh to yourself, Maulana, and to all our listeners of Radio Islam International.
What's up? How are you keeping this week?
Alhamdulillah, nothing to complain about. Looking forward to a nice lineup. More importantly, the interview which is scheduled for today, inshallah.
Inshallah, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reward you for your time and efforts.
Inshallah.
We do remind the listeners, this program is broken up into different segments. This week we'll be taking a look at this week. That's a normal feature on our program. And then, as Mufti Saab had alluded to 1 or 2 minutes ago, we have a very interesting interview coming up. That's in the second segment of our program, the Be of Benefit campaign. And lastly, we take a look at Fiqh of Commerce. We do remind the listeners, if there's any calls that you have, if it is related to economics, finance or business, then you can call us. But we would appreciate if you would keep those calls in the last segment of our program, in the Fiqh of Commerce program, which we would run between 20 to 10, quarter to 10, approximately at that time. If there are any calls and if you could keep those calls in the last segment of our program, we would appreciate it. We would remind you that the number that you can call when you want to call for those questions is 011-854-1548. Alternatively, if you have any questions and you want to send it via SMS or WhatsApp, you can send it to 083-379-4235. 083-379-4235. For that, we start off this week's program with BizWeek Consumer Highlights.
BizWeek on the Tajir Hour with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji.
Mufti Saab, in today's times, before it was maybe, it was probably a luxury. In today's time, it has become such in many, many cases, many, many households. Having a car and owning a car has probably become a necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And together with having a car, if you could make many good, noble intentions that you will do with your car. You'll escort people to the masjid, etc. Some people don't, they live maybe a bit far from the masjid. You might take them, drop them off the masjid, etc. A lot of good things that you can do, help people, etc. What we are looking at is having a car. The car obviously needs to be serviced and maintained. Maybe some tips that you could give after having the car serviced?
Yes, Marana, the thing is, when having a car serviced, first of all, it has become in recent times quite a costly affair to maintain a motor vehicle. So it does, it is indeed a privilege, as you mentioned correctly there, but it comes at a cost, and maintaining a vehicle is necessary. But for many of us who are unaware of how a service is done, what it takes to get a service done, and the extent of a service, because given that the age of the car, the kind of mileage on the vehicle, there will be different kind of components that will be looked into and changed maybe or repaired by a service agent. But for those of us who don't know, we don't know any better. We drive the vehicle off and sometimes you feel a difference, sometimes it's not so good, so you take it back. But you don't actually know whether the service was actually carried out, I suppose if in a service where things were changed, parts of the motor vehicle were changed, in that case, there's just one important tip to provide, given the few articles I picked up this week highlighting fraud in terms of motor vehicle services. So the tip was making reference to the aspect of when you have your motor vehicle serviced, it's a good habit to maybe request for the used or old parts. So you know that the agent definitely changed parts, and the old parts were given to you, the new parts are now in the motor vehicle. Otherwise, you would simply drive off not knowing whether the items have actually been changed, and you paid for it. It is quite a costly affair on the one hand. On the other hand, the last thing you want is to, a few months later, discover that the previous service agent who you used, he duped you into doing the service with him, and he changed absolutely nothing or very little, and he looked for shortcuts, and as a result, you're sitting with this dilemma of the one bill, the first service, and now having to replace those parts, So it may be a good habit to just ask for the parts. Many of us who drive motor vehicles these days, more specifically females, the motor vehicle itself and the service is also paid for by the male spouse, In most cases, the other scenario does occur. But the day the male spouse spouse is not around. These are small basic tips of maintaining a motor vehicle, which women also need to know about, mm-hmm. and also be abreast of, so that they make sure that they do not fall into these kind of scams through at the hands of service agents.
Yeah, definitely, Mufti Sahab. That's a very, very important and a very interesting tip that you have given, you know, to request all parts. You know, for one person that now recently, you know, the person had the car, normally, I'm no mechanic, you know, mm-hmm. that's, I think, more on the Friday night program that they have.
Speaking on my behalf as well.
But, you know, the cam belt in the car, it needs to be changed. I think it's approximately every 200 or something, okay. 1,000 kilometers or something, that that's the part that needs to be changed. And mm-hmm. this person sent his car to a reliable service people, you know, agent that does these car services. And they did the car and they sent the report back that we, you know, the full charges are there, that the scam belt has been changed, and it's a very costly thing, so the entire cost is there. And the person didn't mind it, and it needed to be changed, so I changed it, and it costed me, well, that's just part of it. And the guy comes to find out a little bit later, you know, maybe he drove the car 30,000 kilometers more or something, and one day he's driving, and all of a sudden his car gets stuck, and they take it to manage to get hold of some mechanic that comes in. It's quite far out of where he was staying, and a mechanic comes in. The mechanic tells him need to look at the car, and they find out that the cam belt has snapped. And he's quite shocked that, you know, this was a brand new one that I just put in, and it costed me so much. And he tells the guy, it can't be the cam belt. And the guy says, mechanic, I know I'm talking. This thing is snapped. This thing is gone. And they look at it, and the guy pulls the snap part out, and shows him that, you know what, this is the original one that comes on the car by the manufacturer. This thing was never ever changed. So obviously it's very, very important when we go for you know, when you have your car serviced, then I mean, we're not going to obviously go into the car and look at the, how are we going to know whether that fuel pump and fuel filter and air filter has actually been changed. You won't know, but the best way is if they do give you the old one.
Somewhat linked to that is many a time, you know, in the lifetime of a vehicle, has to be serviced so many times. So a good tip would be to maybe even make sure that each time you service a vehicle, I'm referring to using a service agent other than the official agents. You go to some private person in your street or whatever, make sure you get a list of what items were done. You know, what kind of repair was done to the vehicle, so that 15 years later, you know, as long as you're keeping the car that long, you know, okay, these things were done at the so-and-so date. You know, and you have some kind of, you can track the kind of activity activity on that motor vehicle. Yes.
Okay, that was very interesting. Move this up. An article debunking career myths.
Yes, Marana, you know, when it comes to pursuing a career, there tends to be a view in the community that the very religious class of society are always talking about careerism and the negative impact of having a strong career approach, you know. We do know that from an Islamic perspective, a very sharp career focus, only career, you know, my path must be like this, and I must do this, and at all costs this is what must happen in my career. You know, it can be questioned from an Islamic perspective. But I found it really surprising that in the mainstream media, in print media, there was a very interesting article which featured in this past week debunking four important myths regarding the pursuit of a career, and more specifically any study path. So the first one is that the first myth which they're debunking here is that once you've got the right technical skills, it's easy to get a job. There's a myth out there that once you have the right skills, it will be very easy to get a job. Keep in mind that this is not always the case. It's often the case that where youth have been educated, they lack the softer skills to flourish in the workplace. So, like, you know, simple things like how to put together a CV, preparing for an interview, those same similar finishing aspects of that specific study choice is not there. And as a result, you might have the technical skills, but it doesn't. Having the technical skills does not guarantee a person a job in the workplace. So that's the first myth. The second one the article talks about is that with a university degree, a person is employable. This is another myth which is being debunked by the article, and obviously making reference to the fact that these days university degrees many a time are very strong in theory and in terms of maybe the approach to a specific science, but the application of that science to the real world of work is lacking. And I was just reading an article this week, a very interesting a colleague of mine sent this article to me in relation to the undergrad economics degree offered by the University of Cape Town. And the individual who has been through the course talks about how he, after having gone through the undergrad qualification, feels that the economic theory is very divorced from reality in terms of what is happening in the South African context. So they will teach you about economic modeling and econometrics, microeconomics, macroeconomics, all of those things, but in terms of Keynesian economics, and it will not be linked to the specific scenario of South Africa. And as a result, you find individuals coming out of the institutions and then peddling a specific thought wave, which is more strongly inclined towards the preservation of capitalism, you know, for no reason. In that case, we should be understanding that a university degree does not make a person employable. The degree is on its place, but it may not necessarily demonstrate a skill or ability to carry out a specific task. The third myth which the article debunks is that to ensure you get a well-paying job, you must get a degree. So your job will only be well-paying if you have a degree. Obviously, we've been saying this for a long time now. It doesn't necessarily mean to be paid well, you must have a degree. There are many, many individuals in the world today, around us, in our own communities, who are earning very, very well without a degree, and in some cases even without a matric certificate, you know. So this is what I find surprising once again is the aspect of such an article appearing in mainstream media. And these are messages which ulama and the religious class of society have been saying for a long time and continue to say it. The last myth which the article debunks is that an internship is something which is not relevant to a qualification. This is very important in the current day and age because of the extent to which qualifications, formal qualifications, are falling short in terms of application of that science. There's a need to have or to scout around for a qualification that also incorporates an internship. So say, example, you're doing something in electrical engineering. It's a three-year program or a diploma for a year or so, but there must be some practical component to it. It will just add value. Say, example, if the provider of the course says we'll place you in a work environment for 2 months or 6 months, whatever it is, those kind of internships will actually help and promote the prospect of securing some kind of work out there. So these are just a few myths which the article goes on to talk about very quickly. One is that once you have the right technical skills, it is very easy to get a job. Not necessarily true. Point number two, with a university degree, a person is employable. Not necessarily true. Number three, to ensure that you get a well-paying job, you must have a degree. Not necessarily true. And the last one is that internships are not relevant. These are the four myths which the article talks about.
Shima, you know, over this weekend I was speaking to one youngster and he studied law, and he's also telling me that, you know, I'm struggling to now, you know, I think after law, yeah, after your degree, then you got to go and do articles, etc. Yes. So he's telling me that, you know, that I'm struggling to find a place, and currently I'm with my father back in the shop. And he's even saying that my father doesn't want me to get too comfortable there, because then it becomes, and you know, once I become too comfortable in the shop, and that's where I'm going to stay, and then the three, four years of studying that, I mean, where does it go? We don't know exactly, so it goes to waste, but I mean, what happens to that? So these are things that obviously have to be looked at.
Looked at, definitely, yes.
Customers can be chased away without one even realizing it.
Yes, this happens from time to time, Marana, and I'm just going to cite a very prominent example without mentioning the name of the large retailer in our country. For those who had this experience, they will identify which retailer we're talking about. But there's a very large retailer in countrywide, and their presence is basically countrywide. And if you go to their store, you basically purchase whatever you like and you want. And when you're leaving the store, there's a security measure. The security measure is that the security guard is standing with a handheld device which scans your receipt, your till slip, and then the handheld device has to then scan each item that you've purchased. It makes a slight noise and indicator to the security guard that the item is matching the till slip. Now, if you think about it, this may be a very good mechanism to alleviate pilferage from the store and so forth, but it is very, very frustrating because you had to wait in one queue to pay for your items, and now you're having to wait in another queue to check out and walk out of the store. So this is a very large retailer which is doing this, and hopefully before long they realize that they're actually chasing customers away. So in addition to having their prices so high in recent months, they are now telling customers not to come here, you know. but I think be that as it may, for us, the essence is to derive a lesson from what is happening here. And in our small businesses, I mean, you're manufacturing roti at home and you're selling at home. If you don't have a bell, you're likely to chase customers away. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you have, assuming you have a dog for the right reasons, then too, customers are going to be turned away. Even visitors who might not want to come and hesitate to visit you because you have a dog at home which is barking all the time and in everyone's face. So these are just two. The other one is the aspect of, you know, when you deal with your customers, sometimes people have a habit of giving something over the wall, you know, or giving it through the gate. So I do understand there are security risks, and which is why you're doing this, but to repeatedly do this or to do it with a customer who's not your regular customer, you're likely to chase that person away. So these are just small aspects to learn from and to understand that you've got to look at, when you're running a business, you've got to look at how to make the customer experience the best experience, and you'll know this when that same customer comes back.
Mm-hmm.
The day they come back, it's an indication that the previous experience was largely a positive experience.
Definitely. Okay, Mustafa, tell us commercial effects of a leap year. We know that today being the 8th of March, last week was the 1st of March, and then last week Monday was the 29th of February.
Mm.
You know, there was that picture going around. I don't know if you saw it, but they
Albany.
Had a picture on the bread.
Albany bread, yes.
It is going into the 30th of February or something like that.
Real PR disaster for Albany bread, yes.
But anyway, what are the commercial effects of a leap year?
Something we really take for granted, man. A leap year is an extra day once in every 4 years, right? Now, this is something very interesting. Unfortunately, I couldn't locate all the numbers, but there are definite economic impact. There's definitely an economic impact in terms of having a leap year. Now, I'll just give you a simple example from a consumer point of view. It's proven through reliable statistics that people actually spend more in that year because of one extra day. Just one extra day causes people to spend more, even though you're at work. But the fact that it's one extra day in the year, it's obvious it's not rocket science. You're spending more because of an extra day in the year. For individuals who work on an hourly rate, you know, you're contracting yourself and you charge your employer per hour of your time, they benefit squarely. They benefit. There's a gross benefit for them in the sense that they're working for more hours now.
Yeah.
So they earn more. For individuals who are on contract, month to month, you know, you're working for someone on a contract basis. Every month they pay you an X amount of money. You've actually worked worked a free day. You worked for your employer, and you did not actually in real terms receive compensation for that one day, right? And then the interesting one is the issue of conventional banks, and I'm not too sure about this, but I'm almost sure Islamic banks also operate on the same principle. In the sense that when a conventional bank leases or provides financing for your motor vehicle or your house, and they're calculating a profit rate for the money, for lending you the money, that profit rate is calculated on 366 days of the year, which means that they actually earn interest every year for one extra day, which is quite staggering in terms of the figures. Unfortunately, I just couldn't bring those numbers out, but it's actually quite something to think about. And I'm almost sure, in an Islamic perspective, when you're calculating profit on a transaction, on a selling of a motor vehicle to your client, or even a residential property to a client, there would be a daily rate of calculating the profit. Mm. So although to you and I, as a consumer, as a person engaging in that product, you think that you're paying monthly this amount or annually this amount, but in real terms, the way the bank operates internally, they calculate a daily rate of profit. And that daily rate is for 366 days of the year. So that's why even, you don't be surprised if you look at the contract, it talks about this. It says that the calculation would be based on 366 days a year, assuming that in some years there will be 365 days.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some reference to a leap year in one of those clauses and sub clauses, you know, which are normally characteristic of contracts.
Okay, Mustafa, indeed, that is really interesting. You know, it's something that we overlook, something we don't even consider. We just think it's a leap year, it's just an extra day, but we don't realize all those things that you brought about.
In fact, in the U.S., there's protest action regarding a leap year as a public holiday, to render it a public holiday, purely because of the commercial, shortchanging ordinary people. So on that basis, there's a demand for a public holiday.
Okay, that's definitely very, very interesting information that you have brought forward today. With that, we terminate this week's discussion on BizWeek Consumer Highlights. We're going to go for an ad break, and after the ad break, we will continue. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's gone 34 minutes past the hour of 9. You are listening to the Attajir program. We welcome you, the listener, back onto the program. We move on to the second segment of our program, which is Be of Benefit.
Be of Benefit on the Attajir Hour.
As we had alluded to this when the program just started, alhamdulillah, in the segment we have a very interesting interview coming up, and the interview will be on enlightening people towards being of benefit through marine engineering. Mr. Sahab, you can take it on from there.
Yes, Marana, you know, the ocean economy and the value, the economic value that the ocean brings to South Africa is something which is phenomenal, and the government is beginning to realize this, and this explains Operation Pakisa. A recent study conducted by Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University had quantified the value of our oceans, which indicated that oceans around South Africa were estimated to have a potential to contribute 54 billion rands to GDP and an estimated 316,000 jobs. Now, SAIMENA is the South African Institute of Marine Engineers and Naval Architects, which is the only technical society in South Africa dedicated to marine engineers and naval architects. The institute was founded in 1975 in Cape Town and Durban, and now has branches in Cape Town, Durban, as well as Port Elizabeth, with a total membership of 400 individuals. Its members are from all sections of the industry, which includes seagoing engineers, ship repairers, shipbuilders, marine paint, the South African Navy, naval architects, marine consultants, etc., and just about any person who lives by the marine industry. Now, on the line, we have a very interesting individual by the name of Louis Gontier, who is the president of the Institute of Marine Engineers and Naval Architects. Good morning, Louis, and welcome to the show.
Good morning to you.
Thank you very much for your time this morning.
You're welcome.
Louis, could you, as an opening question, could you tell us exactly what does a marine architect do?
Well, the correct terminology is actual naval architect. A naval architect basically designs floating structures like ships, barges, oil rigs, and ensures that they comply with the regulations and are safe to go to sea. The types of ships they vary from cargo ships, naval vessels, including submarines, yachts, passenger ships, and cargo ships vary in the form of container ships, general cargo ships, oil tankers, bulk carriers, gas tankers, chemical tankers. And all of them have slightly different requirements. So the naval architect needs to design around these requirements. Especially when it comes to yachts and mega yachts, the vessels don't only have to function properly, they have to look very good. So the aesthetics plays an important role as well.
Okay, so your usual building architect is not a normal, it's a totally unrelated aspect to the aspect of being an architect of a vessel which is floating, as you say in your response there.
Well, no, a naval architect or a marine architect, it's almost the same word, but the correct terminology, as I said, is a naval architect.
Yes,
because,
yes, yes.
You know, naval comes from obviously the history of the naval vessels and so on. So,
okay. Now, Louis, can you tell us to what extent is shipbuilding still happening in South Africa? And related to that is, what is the future of naval engineering and architecture in South Africa?
Well, once again, you know, shipbuilding is currently fairly strong in South Africa. You know, Southern African Shipyards is currently building a series of nine tugs for Transnet. They've built several other tugs in the last few years for Transnet. And, you know, in Cape Town, the shipbuilding is also very buoyant at the moment. You've got two fairly big companies operating, and then you've got lots of smaller companies building boats. So the shipbuilding, to a large extent, is pretty buoyant at the moment. But it's a sector that needs support from the government. And if Operation Pakisa comes off as it is being put out, it will only grow the industry and make it a lot stronger. Where the industry can start building vessels for international market.
Mm. Now, given that the state is trying to focus some kind of energy in the form of Operation Pakisa, right? What sort of financial aid is available for interested parties if anyone is interested in looking at becoming a naval architect? And if that funding is available, is it interest free?
Well, you know, as we know in life, very little comes free, and especially for the sector, you know, there's a lot of government organizations around, you know, including the DTI and so on. But generally, all of this funding comes at a higher price than normal institutions. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that the companies don't have to sort of have the guarantees and all those sort of stricter things which the banks require. So it ends up being your interest rates are a lot higher for the funding. But for people who want to go and study, say, marine engineering or naval architecture, there is obviously government support, but I'm not too sure that it comes it comes for free.
Okay. Now, on the same note, I mean, if someone is looking at going the route of a naval architecture or even your marine engineering, what sort of national senior certificate subjects would be required for successful entry into a program?
Well, for most engineering fields, maths and science is a must. You know, you will not get entry into that if you don't have high level maths and science. So those two subjects are extremely important.
Okay, as a basic. Eh? And how long are the courses of your naval architecture or marine engineering?
The marine engineering or naval architects, the courses are generally 4-year courses. Mm-hmm. And you can have either university courses, but which I believe you can. They are offering in South Africa now. Prior to this, it was only done overseas. Mm-hmm. But there are other courses where you can do in 4 years as well. But they're not university courses, but they offer the sort of all-round package where you get practical training and so on, and you become a fully fledged marine engineer and or naval architect. So, but those courses are generally only offered in the UK or other countries.
Okay. Now, you know, the first and most important daunting aspect of being in the profession of a naval architect or even an engineer is that the individual who is likely to be out at sea for extended periods of time. Is this true? I mean, does being in the profession necessarily mean that the engineer or architect will regularly have to be out at sea all the time?
Absolutely not. One can study as a naval architect and or a marine engineer and never go to sea at all. The naval architect is basically somebody who sits and designs vessels with computer programs and so on and so on. But he doesn't necessarily have to ever go to sea in his entire life. For the marine engineers, there are two aspects of it. One you have is a seagoing marine engineer, and one you have is a marine engineer that's based ashore, which becomes more a design engineer and somebody that's working in the shipyards that deals with design of marine engine rooms, etc. So a marine engineer that is studying as a marine engineer that's going to sea will have to obviously go to sea to get his qualifications, but a shore-based marine engineer is also available.
Given that the person is shore-based, I would assume that computer literacy plays a very big part in practicing of the profession.
Absolutely. You know, any engineering computer skills plays a big part, but especially in say not naval architecture, all your computer all the naval architects use computer programs for the design side. And without that, that in-depth knowledge and computer literacy, they will not go very far. So, computers is a must as well.
Fascinating. Louis Gontier, thank you so much for your time this morning. Eh?
You're absolutely welcome. Thank you very much for having me on the radio.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. It's indeed something very, very interesting, and you know, it's something that probably we didn't look at. And I think the question that you asked was very, very pertinent. You know, we normally think that if you're going to be designing ships, etc., designing all these different vessels, you know, the Louis Gontier, he went through all those submarines and whatnot, and we obviously think that, you know, if you're going to be designing it, you're going to be out there at sea. And I think I think that's, you know, here people go for a small fishing thing, 1-2 day fishing thing, and they are really seasick and they're vomiting, etc. So, you know, people maybe just a bit skeptical, maybe just a bit scared that, you know, I don't want to go through this every day, I'll be vomiting and sick. And
well, you know, there's an interesting point I want to make. Aspect is largely one of the drawbacks of our community and the Muslims in general globally is that we have become a consumer society. We just consume. We are the end users of items. And we are not yet looking at becoming the producer of the item. So we all engage in fishing. We it's the more wealthy of us maybe investing in yachts and all those kind of fancy things. But if we looked at providing the yacht, you know, and developing the yacht, and not only the yacht, those large vessels, you see, you just go to the ocean for your maybe week in a year or 2 weeks in a year for a break, and you just take for granted all those vessels which are on the ocean, you know. I'm pretty sure that it offers good quality of life, being on the seaside and on a day-to-day basis, seeing the ocean. And maybe for us Joburgers, we just value the ocean so much, but it does promise some kind of quality of life in terms of your profession, and also adding value to the economy, adding value to the lives of people, and it does seem like the state is quite geared towards adding some value. I hope there's some kind of good structure, and we do see the projects taking off, as Louis Gontier asserted there.
Inshallah, hopefully, and it's something that our youth should look into.
Definitely.
And as you said, you know, the thing is that you hear people from Joburg speak, I mean, you go for a holiday, as you said, for a week or whatever it is, 10 days, and you don't want to come away from there. But you ask the people from the coast, and they'll tell you, you know, we can't remember when was the last we've been. It's very similar to people with swimming pools, you know. The neighbors use the swimming pool more than themselves.
Themselves,
you use it, you put in the swimming pool, and maybe for 6 months, a year, it depends. Children, they might jump in there, they might take a swim in there a few times, and then
novelty wears off. What's interesting, Marana, is the aspect of Louis making reference to the NSC subjects, maths and science. You know, many of us parents who are guiding younger people in these areas, we tend to encourage children to choose maths and science. In matric, you decide what you want to do. It shouldn't be that way. The idea to become something or be of benefit, I'm not talking about careerism, we're talking about being of benefit to people, should be identified very early in the life of a child. Or young person, you know, so very early. The reason why you're doing these two subjects as core subjects is because of XYZ. You know, this is the path you're going. We're not doing it and only decide in matric year what we're going to do, you know.
Well, you know, as you're speaking of that, the other day in the madrasa with the children, the bigger children, and we were speaking to them, and we were just discussing a bit on the different causes, you know, how it has slightly changed in today's time, etc. And in the class, the one student said that I'm doing this certain course, and I asked that, you know, okay, so why are you not doing the normal basic subjects everybody else is doing? How come your course and your subjects are different? And the child very clearly told me that it's because this is what I want to do. If I do decide to study after school, then this is what I want to study. And the rest of the class was actually shocked that you already know what you want to study. So I told them, so when are you both going to decide?
Yes, we'll see.
So I said, but you chose your subjects already, and you're still saying we'll see. So then on what basis did you then choose those subjects? As Louis Gontier said that, you know, you need maths and science to go into marine engineering or naval engineering. So it's something.
Definitely something. And you know, if from my side, just one last point in terms of choice of subjects. It doesn't mean that if a child is deciding to become an alim, they must not choose maths and science. It's perfectly fine, and it's actually encouraged. If their child wants to become an alim or alima, whatever it is, and they have maths and science behind them, it's fine. It's perfectly fine, and it will hold them in good stead, in my view.
Definitely. Okay, we still got one segment to go through, not much time, so with that, we're going to terminate this discussion on Be of Benefit, and we go to the final segment of our program, which is Fiqh of Commerce.
فقاوم ثم قاوم ثم قاوم
Fiqh of Commerce on the Attajir Hour with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji.
Mufti Sahib, before we actually go into Fiqh of Commerce, there's two questions that have come through. One is an SMS, one is on WhatsApp. Let's take the SMS question. The SMS question reads, Assalamu alaikum. What is the best way to buy a property the Sharia way? Can we use Sharia compliant banks like Al Barakah? Shukra.
Look, the reason or the motivation behind purchasing a property is varied among individuals. Some individuals will be purchasing a property for residential purposes, primary residential purposes. Others would be doing it for commercial reasons. You know, we have two, three, four properties, investment purpose, you know. In the case where a person is obtaining or looking to obtain immovable property for residential purposes, the moving forward is largely determined by the need to do so. You know, there's a genuine need for property for residential premises. So that's the underlying motivation behind the obtaining of immovable property, and for that specific purpose, any individual is encouraged to engage in a product that is administered by either a Sharia scholar or fully fledged Sharia board. If you're dealing with an institution that is totally unrelated and doesn't have a Sharia board or Sharia committee, it makes it very difficult to ensure that the product is actually compliant. So you've got to ensure that there is some kind of Sharia mechanism in place to administer whether the product is compliant or not. In terms of obtaining of property for commercial reasons, the motivation is totally different now. And now it's a case where a person has got surplus wealth. I would like to just add an angle of the individual. There's a need for that individual to revisit the motivation. Does it necessarily mean that you have surplus wealth, so you must obtain property? Or should you be saying that as a Muslim, I have a greater purpose of existence. My surplus wealth should actually be channeled in a nice way towards individuals who are less fortunate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very interesting. One more question that has come through. Just going to look for. Okay, the question reads, Assalamu alaikum. Please explain why males get more inheritance than females. I understand that it is because the males of the family have the responsibility to take care of the females. Is this correct? Jazakallah.
The understanding of the individual is spot on, in the sense that the males don't inherit more for no reason. The reason is that they have an added responsibility. Remember, in an ideal Islamic society, women should not be work. They should not be subjected to the agony of the world of work. It's the work of the men. Men have to be the breadwinners, and women can be commercial units. They can be active commercial units in an economy. But in a different, we have a different perspective of how they should be economic units in a society. Be that as it may, the men have a greater responsibility. When they inherit a double fold, it's to support the surviving heirs, the mother, maybe you know sisters, getting them married, making sure that their commercial needs are seen to. So all of those responsibilities come with inheriting a dual share. Yes, it's not a deficiency of the Sharia if there's a problem in society today. Where males do not shoulder their responsibilities. It's not a deficiency in the Sharia, it's a deficiency of society, and it all goes back to how we educate our children, how we raise our children, and that is why the men tend to, in recent times, we're seeing more men moving away from taking on their responsibilities, you know. So yes, that is the precise reason why the males inherit more than females. They have an added responsibility, and the fault of society today is not a fault of the Sharia, it's a fault of society. Let's keep it in those compartments.
It should be treated as such. Mm-hmm. Okay, Mufti Sahib, taking a look at Fiqh of Commerce, we were looking at the rules of hiring. A quick recap, last week we went through three rules with regards to hiring people.
Yes, the first rule we looked at last week was that you can hire an individual, a human being, which is quite normally the case in society and practice. However, the important parts are to ensure that the time frame of the employment is fixed, as well as the nature of work, maybe the remuneration, all the finer details need to be fixed in terms of a contract of engaging that person's services. The second rule was that if the contract is going to be based on time, you're purchasing the time from a person. In that case, even though the individual hasn't actually carried out work, there was no work for the individual, the person still has to be paid. So if you took on a person, let's say you don't have a once-off gardener, you have a fixed gardener at your place. You know, he's your gardener, he only does gardening. Even though the gardening has just been done yesterday and there's no work today, he still has to be paid because you've got a gardener from 8 to 5 for your individual premises. And the third rule was that if the basis of the contract is actually labor, in that case the individual only gets paid according to labor. So if they have an hourly contract or something of that sort, you know, you're individually taking the person on for labor. As soon as the work is done, the individual has to be paid. So if you saw someone walking past your home with a lawnmower, you told the person to cut your grass, he did it and he did it perfectly well, in that case the individual qualifies for the compensation, even though it normally takes half an hour to cut grass, this individual did it in 10 minutes.
Oh.
You know, the fact that the individual carried out the work, the contract, the underlying purpose was the labor, and the labor was perfectly carried out. In that case, the individual still qualifies for compensation.
Okay, this week, you know, the hiring of people is something very common in society. Is there any more rules to go through?
Definitely, quite a bit more. And in terms of the discussion, given the time constraint we have, I'm just going to make quick reference to one or two scenarios or rules. The one rule I want to make reference to is the aspect of, you know, in common parlance, what happens is you contract casual labor, and then you tell the person, I'll give you something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just say, cut my lawn for me, I'm getting visitors this weekend, you know, and I'll give you something, inshallah. Or wash my car, I'll give you something. You know, in that case, that something is quite loaded from an Islamic perspective, because the first point is that you haven't carefully tied up the loose ends of your contract. You haven't stipulated the kind. Maybe you told him what labor. You said wash the car inside out, but you haven't said what compensation you're giving. So it's a bit problematic from that angle, and it's likely to give rise to a dispute. Second of all, the important thing is by saying I'll give you something, you've already committed to the market-related wage for that task.
Mm.
So if the market-related wage for washing of car inside out is 50 rand, when you told that person, I'll give you something, you cannot give the person 30 rand.
Mm.
You've got to give the person 50 rand. Although, in your mind, 30 rand is the something. It's something. Instead of giving you nothing, I gave you something. But that something is quite loaded from a Sharia perspective, and you'll have to pay the full market-related wage, the ajrul mithl, which they call in Arabic. So that's just the one rule, and I'm sure you have some contribution.
And Shima, I think very often we abuse these words, mm-hmm. and we take the word something, and we take the technical meaning of something. Because, I mean, if I said something, then 5 rand is also something in that case. So, I mean, you give the person a very arduous task, a very difficult task, mm-hmm. a very mundane task. You know, it's very difficult. It could be a very hot day,
mm.
and you give him an entire yard to clean, to cut, to trim, to pack, and you know, a lot of work to do, and you just told the guy you're giving him something. Sometimes these people also, you know, from their side, they didn't specify, for them it's a job, they're not worried, they're just going to do the job, and after that entire day of working, you want to try and put a 5 rand, or 10 rand, or 20 rand in his pocket. Mm.
In some cases, there are people who contract casual labor, and you say, I'll give you something, and then you give the person a plate of food.
Mm-hmm.
So you tell the person, cut my grass, and I'll give you something, and then after he cuts the grass, you give him a plate of food.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily correct, even though your plate of food may be valued more than the market-related wage, mm-hmm. for cutting grass. But the fact that there wasn't clarity in that contract, that person didn't know what is the outcome and the end goal of cutting that grass for you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very...
Yeah, and something maybe we should look at is that if we had to do that same job, what would we have wanted in return for it, you know?
Yeah, the reverse psychology is very true. We've got to look at what we would have done or expected.
Okay, Mustafa, I think for that, is there any more rules?
I think we might not do justice to it. The aspect of gratuity in a transaction of lease, where you've got the lease contract in place, the basic minimum fee that you want to pay, but then the whole aspect of giving more than what you actually committed to. Which we can touch on in detail next week, inshallah.
Okay, inshallah. For that, we thank the listeners. We thank the people that send those messages through as well. Jazakallah for listening. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make this program a means of benefit for each and every one of us. And with that, we terminate this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.